Forays. The lobby of the Manila Hotel is about the size of a football field. It smells like last year's perfume, rare tropical orchids, and bug spray. There is a metal detector set up at the front door, because the Prime Minister of Zimbabwe happens to be staying here for a couple of days. Big Africans in good suits stand around the place in clusters of two and three. Many throngs of Nipponese tourists, in their Bermuda shorts, sandals, and white socks, have lodged themselves in the deep, thick, wide sofas and sit quietly, waiting for a prearranged signal. Upper-class Filipino children brandish cylindrical potato chip canisters like tribal chieftains carrying ceremonial maces. A dignified old bellman carrying a hand-pumped tank circulates around the defensive perimeter and silently sprays insecticide against the baseboard. Enter Randall Lawrence Waterhouse in a turquoise polo shirt embroidered with the logo of one of the bankrupt high-tech companies that he and Avi have founded, and relaxed-fit blue jeans held up with suspenders and bulky athletic shoes that once were white. As soon as he got through the formalities at the airport, he perceived that the Philippines are, like Mexico, one of those countries where shoes matter. He approaches the registration counter quickly so that the ravishing young woman in the navy blue uniform will not see his feet. A couple of bellhops are engaged in a pathetic Sisyphean contest with his bag, which is roughly the dimensions and mass of a two-drawer filing cabinet. "You will not be able to find technical books there," Avi told him. "Bring anything you might conceivably need." Randy's suite is a bedroom and living room, both with 14-foot ceilings, and a corridor along one side containing several closets and various plumbing-related technologies. The entire thing is lined in some kind of tropical hardwood stained to a lovely glowing auburn, which would be dismal in the northern latitudes, but here gives it a cozy and cool feeling. The two main rooms each have huge windows with tiny signs by the latch handles warning of tropical insects. Each room is defended from its windows by a multi-layered system of interlocking barriers. Incredibly massive wooden shutters that rumble back and forth on tracks, like freight trains maneuvering in a switching yard. A second layer of shutters, consisting of 2-inch squares of nacre held in a polished wooden grid, sliding on its own set of tracks. Window shears, and finally, heavy-gauge blackout curtains, each suspended from its own set of clanging industrial rails. He orders up a large pot of coffee, which barely keeps him awake long enough to unpack. It is late afternoon. Purple clouds tumble out of the surrounding mountains with the palpable momentum of volcanic mud flows and turn half of the sky into a blank wall striped with vertical bolts of lightning. The walls of the hotel room flash with it as though paparazzi are working outside the window. Below, food vendors in Rizal Park run up and down the sidewalks to get out of the rain, which falls, as it has been doing for about half a millennium, on the sloping black walls of Intermoros. If those walls did not run in straight lines, they could be mistaken for a natural freak of geology, ridges of bare, dark volcanic rock erupting from the grass like teeth from gums. The walls have dovetail-shaped notches that converge to old gun emplacements, providing interlocking fields of fire across a dry moat. Living in the States, you never see anything older than about 2.5 centuries, and you have to visit the eastern fringe of the country to see that. The business traveler's world of airports and taxicabs looks the same everywhere. Randy never really believes he's in a different country until he sees something like Intermoros, and then he has to stand there like an idiot for a long time, ruminating. Right now, across the Pacific Ocean, in a small, tasteful Victorian town located a third of the way from San Francisco to Los Angeles, computers are ceasing up, crucial files are disappearing, and email is careening into intergalactic space because Randy Waterhouse is not there to keep an eye on things. The town in question sports 3 small colleges, one founded by the state of California and 2 founded by Protestant denominations, that are now actively reviled by the majority of their faculty. Taken together, these colleges, the 3 siblings, comprise an academic center of middling importance. Their computer systems are linked into one. They exchange teachers and students. From time to time, they host academic conferences. This part of California has beaches, mountains, redwood forests, vineyards, golf courses, and sprawling penal facilities all over the place. There are plenty of 3- and 4-star hotel rooms, and the 3 siblings, taken together, have enough auditoria and meeting rooms to host a conference of several thousand. Avi's telephone call, some 80 hours ago, arrived in the middle of a major interdisciplinary conference called the Intermediate Phase, 1939 through 1945, of the global hegemony struggle of the 20th century, Common Era. This is a bit of a mouthful, and so it has been given a pithy nickname, War as Text. People are coming from places like Amsterdam and Milan. The conference's organizing committee, which includes Randy's girlfriend Charlene, who actually gives every indication of being his ex-girlfriend now, hired an artist in San Francisco to come up with a poster. He started with a black-and-white halftone photo of a haggard World War II infantryman with a cigarette dangling from his lower lip. He worked this image over using a photocopier, blowing the halftone dots up into rough lumps, like rubber balls chewed by a dog, and wreaking any number of other distortions on it until it had an amazingly stark, striking, jagged appearance. The soldier's pale eyes turned an eerie white. Then he added a few elements in color, red lipstick, blue eyeshadow, and a trace of a red brassiere strap peeking out from the soldier's unbuttoned uniform shirt. The poster won some kind of an award almost the moment it came out. This led to a press release, which in turn led to the posters being enshrined by the news media as an official object of controversy. An enterprising journalist managed to track down the soldier depicted in the original photograph, a decorated combat veteran and retired tool and die maker who, as it happened, was not merely alive, but in excellent health, and since the death of his wife from breast cancer, had spent his retirement roaming around the Deep South in his pickup truck, helping to rebuild black churches that had been torched by drunken yahoos. The artist who had designed the poster then confessed that he had simply copied it from a book and had made no effort whatsoever to obtain permission. The entire concept of getting permission to use other people's work was faulty, since all art was derivative of other art. High-powered trial lawyers converged like dive bombers on the small town in Kentucky where the aggrieved veteran was up on the roof of a black church with a mouthful of nails, hammering down slabs of AD exterior plywood and mumbling, "No comment," to a horde of reporters down on the lawn. After a series of conferences in a room at the town's Holiday Inn, the veteran emerged, accompanied by one of the 5 most famous lawyers on the face of the planet, and announced that he was filing a civil suit against the 3 siblings that would, if it succeeded, turn them and their entire community into a flat, smoking abrasion in the Earth's crust. He promised to split the proceeds between the black churches and various disabled veterans and breast cancer research groups. The organizing committee pulled the poster from circulation, which caused thousands of bootleg copies to go up on the World Wide Web and, in general, brought it to the attention of millions who never would have seen it otherwise. They also filed suit against the artist, whose net worth could be tallied up on the back of a ticket stub. He had assets of about $1,000 and debts, mostly student loans, amounting to $65,000. All of this happened before the conference even began. Randy was aware of it only because Charlene had roped him into providing computer support for the conference, which meant setting up a website and email access for the attendees. When all of this hit the news, email began to flood in and quickly jammed up all of the lines and filled up all of the disk capacity that Randy had spent the last month setting up. Conferees began to arrive. A lot of them seemed to be sleeping in the house where Randy and Charlene had been living together for 7 years. It was a big old Victorian house, and there was plenty of room. They stumbled in from Heidelberg and Paris and Berkeley and Boston, then sat around Randy and Charlene's kitchen table drinking coffee and talking at great length about the spectacle. Randy inferred that the spectacle meant the poster furor. But as they went on and on about it, he sensed that they were using the word not in a conventional sense, but as part of some academic jargon, that it carried a heavy load of shadings and connotations to them, none of which Randy would ever understand unless he became one of them. To Charlene and to all of the people attending War as Text, it was self-evident that the veteran who filed the lawsuit was the very worst kind of human being, just the sort they had gathered together to debunk, burn an effigy, and sweep into the ash bin a post-historical discourse. Randy had spent a lot of time around these people and thought he had gotten used to them, but during those days he had a headache all the time from clenching his teeth, and he kept jumping to his feet in the middle of meals or conversations and going out for solitary walks. This was partly to keep himself from saying something undiplomatic, and partly as a childish but fruitless tactic to get the attention he craved from Charlene. He knew the whole poster saga was going to be a disaster from early on. He kept warning Charlene and the others. They listened coolly, clinically, as if Randy were a test subject on the wrong side of a one-way mirror. Randy forces himself to stay awake long enough for it to get dark. Then he lies in bed for a few hours, trying to sleep. The container port is just north of the hotel, and all night long, Rizal Boulevard along the base of the old Spanish wall is jammed from one end to the other with container-carrying semis. The whole city is a cauldron of internal combustion. Manila seems to have more pistons and exhaust pipes than the rest of the world combined. Even at 2 in the morning, the hotel's seemingly unshakable mass hums and rattles from the seismic energy pouring from all of those motors. The noise detonates car alarms down in the hotel's lot. The noise of one alarm triggers others, and so on. It is not the noise that keeps Randy awake so much as the insane stupidity of this chain reaction. It is an object lesson, the kind of nightmarish, snowballing technological fuck-up that keeps hackers awake at night, even when they can't hear the results. He paws open a Heineken from his minibar and stands in front of the window, looking. Many of the trucks are adorned with brilliant displays of multicolored lights, not quite as flashy as those of the many jeepneys that scurry and jostle among them. Seeing so many people awake and working puts sleep out of the question. He is too jet-lagged to accomplish anything that requires actual thought, but there is one important job he can do, which requires no thinking whatsoever. He starts up his laptop again. Seeming to levitate in the center of his dark room, the screen is a perfect rectangle of light, the color of diluted milk, of a Nordic dawn. This light originates in small fluorescent tubes imprisoned in the polycarbonate coffin of his computer's display. It can only escape through a pane of glass, facing Randy, which is entirely covered by small transistors arranged in a grid, which let photons through, or don't, or let through only those of a particular wavelength, cracking the pale light into colors. By turning those transistors on and off according to some systematic plan, meaning is conveyed to Randy Waterhouse. A good filmmaker could convey a whole story to Randy by seizing control of those transistors for a couple of hours. Unfortunately, there are a lot more laptop computers floating around than there are filmmakers worth paying attention to. The transistors are almost never put into the hands of human beings. They are controlled instead by software. Randy used to be fascinated by software, but now he isn't. It's hard enough to find human beings who are interesting. The pyramid and the eyeball appear. Randy spends so much time using Ordo now that he has his machine booted up automatically. Nowadays, the laptop has only one function for Randy. He uses it to communicate with other people through email. When he communicates with Avi, he has to use Ordo, which is a tool for taking his ideas and converting them into streams of bits that are almost indistinguishable from white noise, so that they can be sent to Avi in privacy. In exchange, it receives noise from Avi and converts it into Avi's thoughts. At the moment, Epiphyte has no assets other than information. It is an idea with some facts and data to back it up. This makes it eminently stealable, so encryption is definitely a good idea. The question is, how much paranoia is really appropriate? Avi sent him encrypted email. When you get to Manila, I would like you to generate a 4096-bit key pair and keep it on a floppy disk that you carry on your person at all times. Do not keep it on your hard disk. Anyone could break into your hotel room while you're out and steal that key. Now, Randy pulls down a menu and picks an item labeled New Key. A box pops up, giving him several key length options. 768 bits, 1024, 1536, 2048, 3072, or custom. Randy picks the latter option and then wearily types in 4096. Even a 768-bit key requires vast resources to break. Add one bit to make it 769 bits long, and the number of possible keys doubles. The problem becomes much more difficult. A 770-bit key is that much more difficult yet, and so on. By using 768-bit keys, Randy and Abby could keep their communications secret from nearly every entity in the world for at least the next several years. A 1024-bit key would be vastly, astronomically more difficult to break. Some people go so far as to use keys 2048 or even 3072 bits in length. These will stop the very best code breakers on the face of the earth for astronomical periods of time, barring the invention of otherworldly technologies such as quantum computers. Most encryption software, even stuff written by extremely security-conscious cryptography experts, can't even handle keys larger than that. But Abby insists on using Ordo, generally considered the best encryption software in the world, because it can handle keys of unlimited length, as long as you don't mind waiting for it to crunch all the numbers. Randy begins typing. He is not bothering to look at the screen. He is staring out the window at the lights on the trucks and the jeepneys. He is only using one hand, just flailing away loosely at the keyboard. Inside Randy's computer is a precise clock. Whenever he strikes a key, Ordo uses that clock to record the current time, down to microseconds. He hits a key at 03 hours, 05 minutes, 56.935788 seconds, and he hits another one at 03 hours, 05 minutes, 57.290664 seconds, or about 0.354876 seconds later. Another 0.372307 seconds later, he hits another one. Ordo keeps track of all these intervals and discards the more significant digits, in this example the 0.35 and the 0.37, because these parts will tend to be similar from one event to the next. Ordo wants randomness. It only wants the least significant digits, say the 76 and the 07 at the very ends of these numbers. It wants a whole lot of random numbers, and it wants them to be very, very random. It is taking somewhat random numbers and feeding them through hash functions that make them even more random. It is running statistical routines on the results to make sure that they contain no hidden patterns. It has breathtakingly high standards for randomness, and it will not stop asking Randy to whack on the keyboard until those standards are met. The longer the key you are trying to generate, the longer this takes. Randy is trying to generate one that is ridiculously long. He has pointed out to Abby in an encrypted email message that if every particle of the matter in the universe could be used to construct one single cosmic supercomputer, and this computer was put to work trying to break a 4096-bit encryption key, it would take longer than the lifespan of the universe. "Using today's technology," Abby shot back, "that is true. But what about quantum computers? And what if new mathematical techniques are developed that can simplify the factoring of large numbers?" "How long do you want these messages to remain secret?" Randy asked in his last message before leaving San Francisco. "5 years? 10 years? 25 years? After he got to the hotel this afternoon, Randy decrypted and read Abby's answer. It is still hanging in front of his eyes, like the afterimage of a strobe. "I want them to remain secret for as long as men are capable of evil." Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic had a few things to say about the information superhighway. He was a 50-ish Yale professor who had just flown in from someplace that had sounded really cool and impressive when he had gone out of his way to mention it several times. His name was Finnish, but he was British, as only a non-British Anglophile could be. Ostensibly, he was here to attend war as text. Really, he was there to recruit Charlene, and really, really, Randy suspected, to fuck her. This was probably not true at all, but just a symptom of how whacked out Randy was getting by this point. Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic had been showing up on television pretty frequently. Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic had a couple of books out. Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic was, in short, parlaying his strongly contrarian view of the information superhighway into more airtime than anyone who hadn't been accused of blowing up a daycare center should get. A dwarf on sojourn in the Shire would probably go to a lot of dinner parties where pompous, boring hobbits would hold forth like this. This dwarf would view the whole thing as entertainment. He would know that he could always go back out into the real world, so much vaster and more complex than these hobbits imagined, and slay a few trolls and remind himself of what really mattered. That was what Randy always told himself, anyway. But on the night in question, it didn't work. Partly because Kavistic was too big and real to be a hobbit, probably more influential in the real world than Randy would ever be. Partly because another faculty spouse at the table, a likable, harmless computerphile named John, decided to take issue with some of Kavistic's statements and was cheerfully shot down for his troubles. Blood was in the water. Randy had ruined his relationship with Charlene by wanting to have kids. Kids raise issues. Charlene, like all of her friends, couldn't handle issues. Issues meant disagreement. Voicing disagreement was a form of conflict. Conflict, acted out openly and publicly, was a male mode of social interaction, the foundation for patriarchal society which brought with it the usual litany of dreadful things. Regardless, Randy decided to get patriarchal with Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic.
"How many slums will we bulldoze to build the information superhighway?" Kavistic said.
This profundity was received with thoughtful nodding around the table. John shifted in his chair as if Kavistic had just dropped an ice cube down his collar.
"What does that mean?" he asked.
John was smiling, trying not to be a conflict-oriented patriarchal hegemonist. Kavistic, in response, raised his eyebrows and looked around at everyone else as if to say,
"Who invited this poor lightweight?"
John tried to dig himself out from his tactical error. As Randy closed his eyes and tried not to wince visibly. Kavistic had spent more years sparring with really smart people over a high table at Oxford than John had been alive.
"You don't have to bulldoze anything. There's nothing there to bulldoze," John pleaded.
"Very well. Let me put it this way,"
Kavistic said magnanimously. He was not above dumbing down his material for the likes of John.
"How many on-ramps will connect the world's ghettos to the information superhighway?"
"Oh, that's much clearer," everyone seemed to think.
"Point well taken, Gib."
No one looked at John, that argumentative pariah. John looked helplessly over at Randy, signaling for help. John was a hobbit, who'd actually been out of the Shire recently, so he knew Randy was a dwarf. Now he was fucking up Randy's life by calling upon Randy to jump up on the table, throw off his homespun cloak, and whip out his two-handed axe. The words came out of Randy's mouth before he had time to think better of it.
"The information superhighway is just a fucking metaphor. Give me a break," he said.
There was a silence as everyone around the table winced in unison. Dinner had now officially crashed and burned.
All they could do now was grab their ankles, put their heads between their knees, and wait for the wreckage to slide to a halt.
"That doesn't tell me very much," Kavistic said. "Everything is a metaphor. The word fork is a metaphor for this object."
He held up a fork.
"All discourse is built from metaphors."
"That's no excuse for using bad metaphors," Randy said.
"Bad? Bad? Who decides what is bad?"
Kavistic said, doing his killer impression of a heavy-lidded, mouth-breathing undergraduate. There was scattered tittering from people who were desperate to break the tension. Randy could see where it was going. Kavistic had gone for the usual academician's ace in the hole. Everything is relative. It's all just differing perspectives. People had already begun to resume their little side conversations, thinking that the conflict was over, when Randy gave them all a start with,
Who decides what's bad? I do.
Even Dr. G.E.B. Kavistic was flustered. He wasn't sure if Randy was joking.
Excuse me?
Randy was in no great hurry to answer the question. He took the opportunity to sit back comfortably, stretch, and take a sip of his wine. He was feeling good.
It's like this, he said. I've read your book. I've seen you on TV. I've heard you tonight. I personally typed up a list of your credentials when I was preparing press materials for this conference, so I know that you're not qualified to have an opinion about technical issues.
Oh, Kavistic said in mock confusion. I didn't realize one had to have qualifications.
I think it's clear, Randy said, that if you are ignorant of a particular subject, that your opinion is completely worthless. If I'm sick, I don't ask a plumber for advice, I go to a doctor. Likewise, if I have questions about the Internet, I will seek opinions from people who know about it.
Funny how all of the technocrats seem to be in favor of the Internet,
Kavistic said cheerily, milking a few more laughs from the crowd.
You have just made a statement that is demonstrably not true, Randy said, pleasantly enough. A number of Internet experts have written well-reasoned books that are sharply critical of it.
Kavistic was finally getting pissed off. All the levity was gone.
So, Randy continued, to get back to where we started, the information superhighway is a bad metaphor for the Internet because I say it is. There might be 1,000 people on the planet who are as conversant with the Internet as I am. I know most of these people. None of them takes that metaphor seriously. QED.
Oh, I see,
Kavistic said, a little hotly. He had seen an opening.
So we should rely on the technocrats to tell us what to think and how to think about this technology, hmm?
The expressions of the others seemed to say that this was a telling blow righteously struck.
I'm not sure what a technocrat is, Randy said.
Am I a technocrat?
I'm just a guy who went down to the bookstore and bought a couple of textbooks on TCP/IP, which is the underlying protocol of the Internet, and read them. And then I signed on to a computer, which anyone can do nowadays, and I messed around with it for a few years. And now I know all about it.
Does that make me a technocrat?
You belonged to the technocratic elite even before you picked up that book,
Kavistic said.
The ability to wade through a technical text and to understand it is a privilege. It is a privilege conferred by an education that is available only to members of an elite class. That's what I mean by technocrat.
I went to a public school, Randy said. And then I went to a state university. From that point on, I was self-educated.
Charlene broke in. She had been giving Randy dirty looks ever since this started, and he has been ignoring her. Now he was going to pay.
And your family?
Charlene asked frostily.
Randy took a deep breath, stifled the urge to sigh. My father is an engineer. He teaches at a state college.
And his father?
A mathematician. Charlene raised her eyebrows. So did nearly everyone else at the table. Case closed.
I strenuously object to being labeled and pigeonholed and stereotyped as a technocrat, Randy said, deliberately using oppressed person's language, maybe in an attempt to turn their weapons against them, but more likely, he thinks, lying in bed at 3 a.m. in the Manila Hotel, out of an uncontrollable urge to be a prick. Some of them, out of habit, looked at him soberly. Etiquette dictated that you give all sympathy to the oppressed. Others gasped in outrage to hear these words coming from the lips of a known and convicted white male technocrat.
No one in my family has ever had much money or power, he said.
I think that the point that Charlene's making is like this, said Tomas,
one of their house guests who had flown in from Prague with his wife Nina. He had now appointed himself conciliator. He paused long enough to exchange a warm look with Charlene.
Just by virtue of coming from a scientific family, you are a member of a privileged elite. You're not aware of it, but members of privileged elites are rarely aware of their privileges.
Randy finished the thought.
Until people like you come along to explain to us how stupid, to say nothing of morally bankrupt, we are.
The false consciousness Tomas is speaking of is exactly what makes entrenched power elites so entrenched, Charlene said.
Well, I don't feel very entrenched, Randy said. I've worked my ass off to get where I've gotten.
A lot of people work hard all their lives and get nowhere, someone said accusingly.
Look out. The sniping had begun. Well, I'm sorry I haven't had the good grace to get nowhere, Randy said, now feeling just a bit surly for the first time. But I have found that if you work hard, educate yourself, and keep your wits about you, you can find your way in this society.
But that's straight out of some 19th century Horatio Alger book, Tomas sputtered.
So? Just because it's an old idea doesn't mean it's wrong, Randy said. A small strike force of white persons had been forming up around the fringes of the table, arms laden with dishes, making eye contact with each other as they tried to decide when it was okay to break up the fight and serve dinner. One of them rewarded Randy with a platter carrying a wigwam devised from slabs of nearly raw tuna. The pro-consensus anti-confrontation elements then seized control of the conversation and broke it up into numerous small clusters of people, all vigorously agreeing with one another. John cast a watery look at Randy, as if to say, "Was it good for you, too?" Charlene was ignoring him intensely. She was caught up in a consensus cluster with Tomas. Nina kept trying to catch Randy's eye, but he studiously avoided this because he was afraid that she wanted to favor him with a smoldering come-hither look, and all Randy wanted to do right then was to go thither. 10 minutes later, his pager went off, and he looked down to see Avi's number on it.